This is Fresh Air. Economist Robert Reich says the war didn't do much to help or hurt the American economy. We had lots of troubles before the war started, and we still have them now that the war's over. One of those problems is the growing gap between the haves and have-nots in America. It's a subject Reich tackles in his new book, The Work of Nations, Preparing Ourselves for 21st Century Capitalism. Reich is a professor at Harvard University and a contributing editor of The New Republic. He worked for both the Ford and Carter administrations. Here's a figure Reich cites to illustrate that growing gap between the haves and the have-nots. Last year, the top fifth of the American population took home more money than the combined income of the rest of the population.
The gap, and that increasingly widening gap between the top 20% of the bottom four-fifths of Americans, derives from the global economy. This is pre-tax, by the way. This isn't as a result of a regressive shift in the tax code, although there has been that regressive shift. What's happening essentially is that if you're highly skilled, if you're highly educated, if you're in the top 20% of the American elite, as it were, professional, managerial, technical, you are in ever greater demand in a world economy that is putting a premium on conceptual problem-solving skills. And therefore, given the integration of the world economy, that is the new transportation communication linkages, the world economy is rewarding you with higher and higher salaries and benefits. Supply and demand, in other words, is working to your advantage. But, and here is the big but, if you are unskilled in the new global economy and you're in the United States, you are competing with millions and millions of unskilled workers who are pouring into the world economy, most of whom are would be delighted to work for a small fraction of the prevailing American wage. Blue-collar jobs are leaving the United States. They're going to Latin America, Southeast Asia, Southern Asia, Southern Europe, where workers are willing to work, happy to work, for $2, $3, $4 an hour. And as a result, those old middle-class jobs that you could get without very much education on an American assembly line are simply vanishing. Supply and demand is working against you if you are unskilled, and therefore your wages and benefits are on a downward escalator.
So if you're unskilled, you're up against two problems. One is the difficulty of finding a job in the first place, but there's another difficulty, which is that the job you find might not pay a living wage.
Well, the chances are that the job you find is going to be in the service sector, the local service economy, retail, restaurant, hospital orderly, probably paying maybe $4 an hour, $4.50 an hour, slightly higher than the minimum wage. But this is not going to keep you and your family out of poverty, or it may not. In fact, what we're seeing these days is that in order to maintain family incomes, you have to have two wage earners in most families, whereas 15 years ago, 20 years ago, you could do it with one wage earner. Most Americans are dimly aware of the fact that if you are unskilled, if you're a non-supervisory worker, you now have a wage that, in inflation-adjusted terms, adjusted for inflation, is about what your wage was in 1958. Well, that's a conversation. It's a conversation stopper.
Yeah, I'll say.
And again, it's because of these centrifugal forces in the world economy. The only way out, Terry, it seems to me, I mean, we're going to always have a lot of workers that are in the local service economy, but there are many Americans who could be performing high-value-added complex jobs in the new world economy and be making much, much more money if they had the right education and training, if they had the right to preschool education, if they had all the advantages that many of the people in the top fifth have, but they don't.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Reich, and he's an economist at Harvard University and the author of the new book, The Work of Nations, Preparing Ourselves for 21st Century Capitalism. We'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Harvard economist Robert Reich is my guest, author of the new book, The Work of Nations. You make the case here that, in fact, the top fifth, the wealthier fifth, the fifth that's making as much money as the other four-fifths put together, that they're quietly seceding from the nation and they're building their own economy, their own little world.
This is happening. I don't mean to blame the top fifth. Many people don't realize who are in the top fifth that this is happening, but they are seceding in the sense that they are less and less dependent on the rest of the four-fifths of the population. They're moving into their own enclaves, their own economic enclaves. You know, zip code marketing is all the rage these days because many marketers know that the best way of reaching affluent households is by zip code. Where you live very much determines how much you make. There's a direct correlation. If you're in the fortunate fifth, you probably have pretty good schools. Some of the best high schools and grammar schools in America are in the suburbs, wealthy suburbs. As the federal government gets out of the education business, as states are hard-pressed and therefore put more and more of the onus of financing education on the local townships, what we find, logically, is that as Americans segregate, the top fifth goes to school districts that can be good. They can afford good schools. The tax base is pretty good. Everybody else is struggling. They're struggling with bad schools that are growing poorer. Private health clubs instead of public parks, private libraries instead of public libraries. You see, again, the top fifth of Americans is seceding into their own worlds in a way that have less and less to do with the world inhabited by most other Americans.
And you see condominiums and residential communities as contributing to this trend. How so?
Well, it's part of the same thing. The growth of residential, private residential communities that pay for people to mend the grass and maintain the lights and maintain the streetlights and maintain the swimming pools and keep the roads in good repair. These are like private little governments. But the difference is that they are financed by people who have seceded, in a way, from public government and created their own little world. The number of private security guards in the United States now exceeds the number of public police officers. And, in fact, in the private sector, private security guards is almost the fastest-growing occupational group.
Do you think this means that the people in the top fifth economically don't care as much about the health of their municipal government, their city government, because they don't rely on it in the way they once did?
They rely on it far less, that's right. And they're paying, they may feel like they're paying more taxes, but actually the top fifth, the tax burden is shifting to the bottom four-fifths if you include state taxes, local taxes, and also the federal income tax, which compared to what it was in the late 70s is far more regressive. The top fifth is less dependent on the rest of the population, partly because of the global economy. You know, as I mentioned in the book, in the 1830s, to go way back in time, Alexis de Tocqueville, the French magistrate, he was a young man, came over to America and asked himself, why is it that Americans are willing to contribute and sacrifice for the general welfare? Back in Europe, he said, everybody used the excuses, in a way. They said it was justified by noblesse oblige, duty, honor, patriotism. He thought that those were very hypocritical reasons. In the United States, when he asked people why they sacrificed so readily for the commonwealth, people said, enlightened self-interest. In the long run, I'll get it back. In the long run, it'll help me, and therefore, if everybody around me is more productive, I'll sacrifice and I'll invest in their education, I'll invest in good municipal government and services, because it'll help me. But in modern America, in an America that is part of a global economy, that rationale may be somewhat less persuasive. My neighbor, Terry, back in Cambridge, is a computer engineer who's working on a project for Siemens, the giant German electronics firm. It's being financed out of Tokyo. The routine computer coding is being done in Bulgaria, and the hardware is being put together in Mexico. My neighbor is sort of a typical, maybe a slightly extreme version, of a new global cosmopolitan player who is less dependent for his economic welfare on the productivity of the future productivity of those kids in the next town, in Chelsea or in Somerville, Massachusetts.
Gee, that's bad news if you can't rely on enlightened self-interest for a few good things.
Well, I wish we could rely, as we could in the 1830s, on enlightened self-interest. I think it's a less powerful motive in the new global economy.
What should the top fifth be held responsible for, held accountable for?
I think that even though America is no longer a unique and separate economy. That is, money and technology and corporations, plant and equipment now go across borders almost at the speed of an electronic impulse. Nevertheless, we are still a society in which we have mutual obligations. We have obligations toward one another, to invest in the future productivity of one another. I'm not suggesting that We want to merely redistribute income. It's not necessary only to take from the wealthy and give to the needy, although that certainly is a problem. One out of every five American kids is now in poverty, the highest rate of poverty we've had in this country for 25 years. But we also need to expect, and I think even in the long term this is much more important, that the top 20% that now have more income than the bottom four-fifths put together, that they invest in the productivity of the bottom 80%. And that means preschool education. It means Head Start. Head Start, you know, is one of the most successful programs the government has ever put on. Every study shows that the future of those kids that go through a Head Start program is so much more likely to be a positive, productive future than kids that don't. But only about half of the kids who are eligible now have access to Head Start programs. We have a level of infant mortality in this country that puts us number 19 behind 18 other nations. And you can look at other statistics that are just as damning.
Are you making the argument for more taxes on the wealthy
or
more philanthropy from the wealthy?
It's three things, Terry. It's a tax burden. We have to go to a more progressive tax system, and a lot of those taxes have to go into education and training and public health and infrastructure. We haven't built a new airport in this country since 1974. But we also have to expect from the top 20% more contributions. You know, George Bush talks about 1,000 points of light, but actually there have been fewer and fewer points of light. Charitable contributions by the wealthy tend to go to public charities that more likely than not help the wealthy. That is, I'm talking about concert halls and symphonies, elite universities, places where the wealthy gather, but very little of that charitable contribution from the top 20% goes to help the poor in any genuine, meaningful sense. And finally, we're talking about American corporations and their policies of investing in the American workforce. The relatively uneducated, maybe somebody with just a high school education, investing in their training. Other nations, like Germany, have very elaborate apprenticeship programs in which they take high school dropouts or high school graduates, the public sector, the private sector working together. Corporations invest substantially in the training of German youth. Well, we ought to be doing the same thing. We don't do it in this country.
The subtitle of your new book is Preparing Ourselves for 21st Century Capitalism. I take that to mean that you still have faith in capitalism.
Well, capitalism, broadly conceived as a way in which the private sector is the engine of economic development, capitalism has won the race. There's no question anymore. Communism doesn't work. Socialism doesn't work. But that doesn't mean that the public sector has no role to play. And I think often in the United States we tend to forget the fact that the public sector has played and continues to play such a vital role. American corporations in this country last year, one out of every $3 they spent for research and development came from Uncle Sam. In fact, if you look at the three most successful export industries in this country, aerospace, pharmaceuticals, agriculture, we find that Uncle Sam, the federal government, is deeply involved in all three industries. But the point is we don't do it very well. We don't understand how the public sector ought to be involved. We use the pretext very often of national security. In fact, I was thinking the other day, Terry, I was talking about education, and one of the most successful education programs ever launched by the federal government in the wake of Sputnik in the late 50s, we trained a whole generation of engineers and scientists and foreign language specialists. It helped us right through the 60s and 70s with a whole generation of technical specialists. We called it the National Defense Education Act, and we pretended it was all about catching up with the Soviets in space. Or to take one other example, in the 1950s, we launched an interstate highway program that was vitally important for our economic development. Do you remember what we called it?
No.
The National Defense Highway Act. And we pretended that it was all about getting munitions rapidly from places like Boston to San Diego in the event of a national emergency. Well, it may have been about that, but it was also about our economic development as a nation. We need to understand that these investments, these public investments, are a critical part of capitalism. If we're going to be successful in the 21st century, every other factor of production, technology and corporations, planted equipment, money, they're all footloose. They go everywhere. But our skills, our education, and our infrastructure, that is, our highways and bridges and transportation and communication linkages, those things are relatively immobile, and on those will depend our future standard of living.
Robert Reich is the author of the new book, The Work of Nations. Tomorrow, more on the meaning of the new global economy. This is Fresh Air.